boys through to Libya. Every attempt had been paid for at a high price. Tonight we tried it again. A convoy of 7 ships left, accompanied by 2 10,000-ton cruisers and 10 destroyers. All, I mean all, our ships were sunk. The British returned to their ports at Malta after having slaughtered us. Belatedly, the Germans diverted several U-boats from the Battle of the Atlantic to the Mediterranean, and Kesselring was given additional squadrons of planes for the bases in Sicily. It was decided to neutralize Malta and destroy, if possible, the British fleet in the eastern Mediterranean. Success was immediate. By the end of 1941, the British had lost 3 battleships, an aircraft carrier, 2 cruisers, and several destroyers and submarines. And what was left of their fleet was driven to Egyptian bases. Malta had been battered by German bombers day and night for weeks. As a result, Axis supplies got through. In January, not a ton of shipping was lost, and Rommel was able to build up his forces for the big push into Egypt. In March, Admiral Raeder talked Hitler into approving plans not only for Rommel's offensive toward the Nile, Operation Naida, but for the capture of Malta by parachute troops, Operation Hercules. The drive from Libya was to begin at the end of May, and Malta was to be assaulted in mid-July. But on June 15th, while Rommel was in the midst of his initial successes, Hitler postponed the attack on Malta. He could spare neither troops nor planes from the Russian front, he explained to Raeder. A few weeks later, he postponed Hercules again, saying it could wait until after the summer offensive in the east had been completed and Rommel had conquered Egypt. Malta could be kept quiet in the meantime, he advised, by continued bombing. But it was not kept quiet. And for this failure, either to neutralize it or to capture it, the Germans would shortly pay a high price. A large British convoy got through to the besieged island on June 16th, and though several warships and freighters were lost, this put Malta back in business. Spitfires were flown to the island from the U.S. aircraft carrier Wasp and soon drove the attacking Luftwaffe bombers from the skies. Rommel felt the effect. 3/4 of his supply ships thereafter were sunk. He had reached El Alamein with just 13 operational tanks. According to General Beierlein's post-war testimony, he probably exaggerated his losses. Allied intelligence gave Rommel 125 tanks. Our strength, he wrote in his diary on July 3rd, has faded away. And at a moment when the pyramids were almost in sight, and beyond, the great prize of Egypt and Suez. This was another opportunity lost, and one of the last which Hitler would be afforded by Providence and the fortunes of war. The German Summer Offensive in Russia, 1942. By the end of the summer of 1942, Adolf Hitler seemed to be once more on top of the world. German U-boats were sinking 700,000 tons of British-American shipping a month in the Atlantic, more than could be replaced in the booming shipyards of the United States, Canada, and Scotland. Though the Führer had denuded his forces in the west of most of their troops and tanks and planes in order to finish with Russia, there was no sign that summer that the British and Americans were strong enough to make even a small landing from across the Channel. They had not even risked trying to occupy French-held Northwest Africa, though the weakened French of divided loyalties had nothing much with which to stop them even if they attempted to, and the Germans nothing at all except a few submarines and a handful of planes based in Italy and Tripoli. The British Navy and Air Force had been unable to prevent Germany's 2 battle cruisers, Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, and the heavy cruiser Prince Eugen, from dashing up the English Channel in full daylight and making their way safely home from Brest. This had taken place on February 11th to 12th, 1942, and had caught the British by surprise. Only weak naval and aircraft forces were rounded up in time to attack the German fleet, and they inflicted little damage. Vice Admiral Ciliax, who led the dash, commented the Times of London, has succeeded where the Duke of Medina Sidonia failed. Nothing more mortifying to the pride of sea power has happened in home waters since the 17th century. Hitler had feared that the British and Americans would certainly try to occupy northern Norway. That was why he had insisted on the dash from Brest so that the 3 heavy ships there could be used for the defense of Norwegian waters. Norway, he told Raeder at the end of January 1942, is the zone of destiny. It had to be defended at all costs. As it turned out, there was no need. The Anglo-Americans had other plans for their limited forces in the West. On the map, the sum of Hitler's conquests by September 1942 looked staggering. The Mediterranean had become practically an Axis lake, with Germany and Italy holding most of the northern shore from Spain to Turkey and the southern shore from Tunisia to within 60 miles of the Nile. In fact, German troops now stood guard from the Norwegian North Cape on the Arctic Ocean to Egypt, from the Atlantic at Brest to the southern reaches of the Volga River on the border of Central Asia. German troops of the 6th Army had reached the Volga just north of Stalingrad on August 23rd. 2 days before, the swastika had been hoisted on Mount Elbrus, the highest peak, 18,481 feet, in the Caucasus Mountains. The Mykop oil fields, producing annually 2.5 million tons of oil, had been captured on August 8th, though the Germans found them almost completely destroyed, and by the 25th, Kleist's tanks had arrived at Mozdok, only 50 miles from the main Soviet oil center around Grozny, and a bare 100 miles from the Caspian Sea. On the 31st, Hitler was urging Field Marshal List, commander of the armies in the Caucasus, to scrape up all available forces for the final push to Grozny so that he could get his hands on the oil fields. On that last day of August, too, Rommel launched his offensive at El Alamein with every hope of breaking through to the Nile. Although Hitler was never satisfied with the performance of his generals, he had sacked Field Marshal von Bock, who commanded the whole southern offensive on July 13th, and, as Halder's diary reveals, had constantly nagged and cursed most of the other commanders, as well as the general staff, for not advancing fast enough, he now believed that the decisive victory was in his grasp. He ordered the 6th Army and the 4th Panzer Army to swing north along the Volga, after Stalingrad was taken, in a vast encircling movement, which would enable him eventually to advance on Central Russia and Moscow from the east, as well as from the west. He believed the Russians were finished, and Halder tells of him at this moment talking of pushing with part of his forces through Iran to the Persian Gulf. Soon he would link up with the Japanese in the Indian Ocean. He had no doubt of the accuracy of a German intelligence report on September 9th that the Russians had used up all their reserves on the entire front. In a conference with Admiral Raeder at the end of August, his thoughts were already turning from Russia, which he said he now regarded as a blockade-proof Lebensraum, to the British and Americans, who would soon, he was sure, be brought to the point of discussing peace terms. And yet, as General Kurt Zeitzler later recalled, appearances even then, rosy as they were deceptive. Almost all the generals in the field, as well as those on the general staff, saw flaws in the pretty picture. They could be summed up. The Germans simply didn't have the resources, the men or the guns or the tanks or the planes or the means of transportation, to reach the objectives Hitler had insisted on setting. When Rommel tried to tell this to the warlord in respect to Egypt, Hitler ordered him to go on sick leave in the mountains of the Semmering. When Halder and Field Marshal List attempted to do the same in regard to the Russian front, they were cashiered. Even the rankest amateur strategist could see the growing danger to the German armies in southern Russia as Soviet resistance stiffened in the Caucasus and at Stalingrad, and the season of the autumn rains approached. The long northern flank of the 6th Army was dangerously exposed along the line of the Upper Don for 350 miles from Stalingrad to Voronezh. Here Hitler had stationed 3 satellite armies, the Hungarian 2nd south of Voronezh, the Italian 8th farther southeast, and the Romanian 3rd on the right at the bend of the Don just west of Stalingrad. Because of the bitter hostility of Romanians and Hungarians to each other, their armies had to be separated by the Italians. In the steppes south of Stalingrad, there was a 4th satellite army, the Romanian 4th. Aside from their doubtful fighting qualities, all these armies were inadequately equipped, lacking armored power, heavy artillery, and mobility. Furthermore, they were spread out very thinly. The Romanian 3rd Army held a front of 105 miles with only 69 battalions. But these Allied armies were all Hitler had. There were not enough German units to fill the gap, and since he believed, as he told Halder, that the Russians were finished, he did not unduly worry about this exposed and lengthy Don flank. Yet it was the key to maintaining both the 6th Army and the 4th Panzer Army at Stalingrad and Army Group A in the Caucasus. Should the Don flank collapse, not only would the German forces at Stalingrad be threatened with encirclement, but those in the Caucasus would be cut off. Once more, the Nazi warlord had gambled. It was not his first gamble of the summer's campaign. On July 23rd, at the height of the offensive, he made another. The Russians were in full retreat between the Donets and Upper Don rivers, falling rapidly back toward Stalingrad to the east and toward the Lower Don to the south. A decision had to be made. Should the German forces concentrate on taking Stalingrad and blocking the Volga River? Or should they deliver their main blow in the Caucasus in quest of Russian oil? Earlier in the month, Hitler had pondered this crucial question, but had been unable to make up his mind. At first, the smell of oil had tempted him most, and on July 13th, he had detached the 4th Panzer Army from Army Group B, which had been driving down the Don toward the river's bend and Stalingrad just beyond, and sent it south to help Kleist's 1st Panzer Army get over the lower Don near Rostov and on into the Caucasus toward the oil fields. At that moment, the 4th Panzer Army probably could have raced on to Stalingrad, which was then largely undefended, and easily captured it. By the time Hitler realized his mistake, it was too late, and then he compounded his error. When the 4th Panzer Army was shifted back toward Stalingrad a fortnight later, the Russians had recovered sufficiently to be able to check it, and its departure from the Caucasus front left Kleist too weak to complete his drive to the Grozny oil fields. Kleist confirmed this to Little Heart. The 4th Panzer Army could have taken Stalingrad without a fight at the end of July, but was diverted south to help me in crossing the Don. I did not need its aid, and it merely congested the roads I was using. When it turned north again a fortnight later, the Russians had gathered just sufficient forces at Stalingrad to check it. By that time, Kleist needed the additional tank force. We could have reached our goal, the Grozny oil, if my forces had not been drawn away to help the attack on Stalingrad, he added. Little Heart, The German General's Talk, pages 169 to 171. The shifting of this powerful armored unit back to the drive on Stalingrad was one result of the fatal decision which Hitler made on July 23rd. His fanatical determination to take both Stalingrad and the Caucasus at the same time, against the advice of Holder and the field commanders, who did not believe it could be done, was embodied in Directive No. 45, which became famous in the annals of the German army. It was one of the most fateful of Hitler's moves in the war, for in the end, and in a very short time, it resulted in his failing to achieve either objective and led to the most humiliating defeat in the history of German arms, making certain that he could never win the war and that the days of the thousand-year Third Reich were numbered. General Halder was appalled, and there was a stormy scene at Werewolf headquarters in the Ukraine near Vinnytsia, to which Hitler had moved on July 16th in order to be nearer the front. The chief of the general staff urged that the main forces be concentrated on the taking of Stalingrad, and tried to explain that the German army simply did not possess the strength to carry out two powerful offensives in two different directions. When Hitler retorted that the Russians were finished, Halder attempted to convince him that, according to the army's own intelligence, this was far from the case. The continual underestimation of enemy possibilities, Halder noted sadly in his diary that evening, takes on grotesque forms and is becoming dangerous. Serious work has become impossible here. Pathological reaction to momentary impressions and a complete lack of capacity to assess the situation and its possibilities give this so-called leadership a most peculiar character. Later, the chief of the general staff, whose own days at his post were now numbered, would come back to this scene and write, "Hitler's decisions had ceased to have anything in common with the principles of strategy and operations, as they have been recognized for generations past. They were the product of a violent nature following its momentary impulses, which recognized no limits to possibility and which made its wish dreams the father of its acts." As to what he called the Supreme Commander's pathological overestimation of his own strength and criminal underestimation of the enemy's, Halder later told a story. Once, when a quite objective report was read to him showing that still in 1942 Stalin would be able to muster from 1 to 1.25 million fresh troops in the region north of Stalingrad and west of the Volga, not to mention 500,000 men in the Caucasus, and which provided proof that Russian output of frontline tanks amounted to at least 1,200 a month, Hitler flew at the man who was reading with clenched fists and foam in the corners of his mouth and forbade him to read any more of such idiotic twaddle. "You didn't have to have the gift of a prophet," says Halder, "to foresee what would happen when Stalin unleashed those 1.5 million troops against Stalingrad and the Don flank. I pointed this out to Hitler very clearly. The result was the dismissal of the chief of the Army General Staff. Halder relates that, quite by accident, he came across in the Ukraine about that time a book about Stalin's defeat of General Denikin between the Don Bend and Stalingrad during the Russian Civil War. He says the situation then was very similar to that of 1942, and that Stalin exploited masterfully Denikin's weak defenses along the Don. Hence, he adds, came the changing of the name of the city from Tsaritsyn to Stalingrad. This took place on September 24th. Already on the 9th, upon being told by Keitel that Field Marshal List, who had the overall command of the armies in the Caucasus, had been sacked, Halder learned that he would be the next to go. The Führer, he was told, had become convinced that he was no longer equal to the psychic demands of his position. Hitler explained this in greater detail to his General Staff Chief at their farewell meeting on the 24th. "You and I have been suffering from nerves. Half of my nervous exhaustion is due to you. It is not worth it to go on. We need National Socialist ardor now, not professional ability. I cannot expect this of an officer of the old school such as you." So spoke, Halder commented later, not a responsible warlord, but a political fanatic. And so departed Franz Halder. He was not without his faults, which were similar to those of his predecessor, General Beck, in that his mind was often confused and his will to action paralyzed. And though he had often stood up to Hitler, however ineffectually, he had also, like all of the other army officers who enjoyed high rank during World War II, gone along with him, and for a long time abetted his outrageous aggressions and his conquests. Yet he had retained some of the virtues of more civilized times. He was the last of the old-school general staff chiefs that the Army of the Third Reich would have. He was replaced by General Kurt Zeitzler, a younger officer of a different stripe who was serving as chief of staff to Rundstedt in the West, and who endured in the post, which once, especially in the First World War, had been the highest and most powerful in the German army, as little more than the Führer's office boy until the attempt against the dictator's life in July 1944. The sacking of Halder was a loss not only to the army, but to historians of the Third Reich, for his invaluable diary ends on September 24, 1942. He was eventually arrested, placed in the concentration camp at Dachau along with such illustrious prisoners as Schuschnigg and Schacht, and liberated by U.S. forces at Niederdorf, South Tyrol, on April 28, 1945. Since then, up to the time of writing, he has collaborated with the U.S. Army in a number of military historical studies of World War II. His generosity to this writer in answering queries and pointing out sources has already been noted. The faithful and fanatically loyal General Jodl, chief of operations at OKW, also was in Hitler's doghouse at this time. He had opposed the sacking of Field Marshal List and General Halder, and his defense of them sent Hitler into such a rage that for months he refused to shake hands with Jodl or dine with him or any other staff officer. Hitler was on the point of firing Jodl at the end of January 1943 and replacing him with General Paulus, but it was too late. Paulus, as we shall shortly see, was no longer available. A change in general staff chiefs did not change the situation of the German army, whose twin drives on Stalingrad and the Caucasus had now been halted by stiffening Soviet resistance. All through October, bitter street fighting continued in Stalingrad itself. The Germans made some progress, from building to building, but with staggering losses, for the rubble of a great city, as everyone who has experienced modern warfare knows, gives many opportunities for stubborn and prolonged defense, and the Russians, disputing desperately every foot of the debris, made the most of them. Though Halder and then his successor warned Hitler that the troops in Stalingrad were becoming exhausted, the Supreme Commander insisted that they push on. Fresh divisions were thrown in and were soon ground to pieces in the inferno. Instead of a means to an end, the end had already been achieved when German formations reached the western banks of the Volga north and south of the city and cut off the river's traffic, Stalingrad had become an end in itself. To Hitler, its capture was now a question of personal prestige. Even when Zeitzler got up enough nerve to suggest to the Führer that in view of the danger to the long northern flank along the Don, the Sixth Army should be withdrawn from Stalingrad to the elbow of the Don, Hitler flew into a fury. "Where the German soldier sets foot, there he remains," he stormed. Despite the hard going and the severe losses, General Paulus, commander of the Sixth Army, informed Hitler by radio on October 25th that he expected to complete the capture of Stalingrad at the latest by November 10th. Cheered up by this assurance, Hitler issued orders the next day that the Sixth Army and the Fourth Panzer Army, which was fighting south of the city, should prepare to push north and south along the Volga as soon as Stalingrad had fallen. It was not that Hitler was ignorant of the threat to the Don flank. The OKW diaries make clear that it caused him considerable worry. The point is that he did not take it seriously enough, and that, as a consequence, he did nothing to avert it. Indeed, so confident was he that the situation was well in hand, that on the last day of October, he, the staff of OKW, and the Army General Staff abandoned their headquarters at Vinnytsia in the Ukraine and returned to Vulchansa at Rostenburg. The Führer had practically convinced himself that if there were to be any Soviet winter offensive at all, it would come on the central and northern fronts. He could handle that better from his quarters in East Prussia. Hardly had he returned there when bad news reached him from another and more distant front. Field Marshal Rommel's Afrika Corps was in trouble. The first blow, El Alamein and the Anglo-American landings. The Desert Fox, as he was called on both sides of the front, had resumed his offensive at El Alamein on August 31st with the intention of rolling up the British Eighth Army and driving on to Alexandria and the Nile. There was a violent battle in the scorching heat on the 40-mile desert front between the sea and the Katara Depression, but Rommel could not quite make it, and on September 3rd he broke off the fighting and went over to the defensive. At long last, the British Army in Egypt had received strong reinforcements in men, guns, tanks, and planes, many of the last two from America. It had also received on August 15th two new commanders, an eccentric but gifted general named Sir Bernard Law Montgomery, who took over the Eighth Army, and General Sir Harold Alexander, who was to prove to be a skillful strategist and a brilliant administrator, and who now assumed the post of commander-in-chief in the Middle East. Shortly after his setback, Rommel had gone on sick leave on the Semmering in the mountains below Vienna to receive a cure for an infected nose and a swollen liver, and it was there that on the afternoon of October 24th he received a telephone call from Hitler. "Rommel, the news from Africa sounds bad. The situation seems somewhat obscure. Nobody appears to know what has happened to General Stumme. Do you feel capable of returning to Africa and taking over there again?" Stumme, who was acting commander in the absence of Rommel, had died of a heart attack the first night of the British offensive while fleeing on foot over the desert from a British patrol that had almost captured him. Though a sick man, Rommel agreed to return immediately. By the time he got back to headquarters west of El Alamein on the following evening, the battle, which Montgomery had launched at 9:40 p.m. on October 23rd, was already lost. The Eighth Army had too many guns, tanks, and planes, and though the Italian-German lines still held and Rommel made desperate efforts to shift his battered divisions to stem the various attacks and even to counterattack, he realized that his situation was hopeless. He had no reserves of men or tanks or oil. The RAF, for once, had complete command of the skies and was pounding his troops and armor and remaining supply dumps mercilessly. On November 2nd, Montgomery's infantry and armor broke through on the southern sector of the front and began to overrun the Italian divisions there. That evening, Rommel radioed Hitler's headquarters in East Prussia, 2,000 miles away, that he could no longer hold out and that he intended to withdraw, while there was still the opportunity, to the Fuka position 40 miles to the west. He had already commenced to do so when a long message came over the air the next day from the Supreme Warlord. To Field Marshal Rommel, "I and the German people are watching the heroic defensive battle waged in Egypt with faithful trust in your powers of leadership and in the bravery of the German-Italian troops under your command. In the situation in which you now find yourself, there can be no other consideration save that of holding fast, of not retreating one step, of throwing every gun and every man into the battle. You can show your troops no other way than that which leads to victory or to death. Adolf Hitler." This idiotic order meant, if obeyed, that the Italo-German armies were condemned to swift annihilation. And for the first time in Africa, Beierlein says, Rommel did not know what to do. After a brief struggle with his conscience, he decided, over the protests of General Ritter von Thoma, the actual commander of the German Africa Corps, who said he was withdrawing in any case, to obey his supreme commander. The next day, November 4th, after telling Bayerlein, "Hitler's order is a piece of unparalleled madness. I can't go along with this any longer," General Fantoma donned a clean uniform with the insignia of his rank and his decorations, stood by his burning tank until a British unit arrived, surrendered, and in the evening dined with Montgomery at his headquarters mess. "I finally compelled myself to take this decision," Rommel wrote later in his diary, "because I myself have always demanded unconditional obedience from my soldiers, and I therefore wish to accept this principle for myself." Later, as a subsequent diary entry declares, he learned better. Reluctantly, Rommel gave the order to halt the withdrawal, and at the same time sent off a courier by plane to Hitler to try to explain to him that unless he were permitted to fall back immediately, all would be lost. But events were already making that trip unnecessary. On the evening of November 4th, at the risk of being court-martialed for disobedience, Rommel decided to save what was left of his forces and retreat to Fuka. Only the remnants of the armored and motorized units could be extricated. The foot soldiers, mostly Italian, were left behind to surrender, as indeed the bulk of them already had done. Rommel's losses at El Alamein were 59,000 killed, wounded, and captured, of whom 34,000 were Germans out of a total force of 96,000 men. On November 5th came a curt message from the Führer. "I agree to the withdrawal of your army into the Fuka position." But that position already had been overrun by Montgomery's tanks. Within 15 days, Rommel had fallen back 700 miles to beyond Benghazi with the remnants of his African army, some 25,000 Italians, 10,000 Germans, and 60 tanks. And there was no opportunity to stop even there. This was the beginning of the end for Adolf Hitler, the most decisive battle of the war yet won by his enemies, though a second and even more decisive one was just about to begin on the snowy steppes of southern Russia. But before it did, the Führer was to hear further bad news from North Africa, which spelled the doom of the Axis in that part of the world. Already on November 3rd, when the first reports had come in of Rommel's disaster, the Führer's headquarters had received word that an Allied armada had been sighted assembling at Gibraltar. No one at OKW could make out what it might be up to. Hitler was inclined to think it was merely another heavily guarded convoy for Malta. This is interesting because more than a fortnight earlier, on October 15th, the OKW staff chiefs had discussed several reports about an imminent Anglo-Saxon landing in West Africa. The intelligence apparently came from Rome, for Chano a week before, on October 9th, noted in his diary after a talk with the chief of the military secret service that the Anglo-Saxons are preparing to land in force in North Africa. The news depressed Chano. He foresaw, correctly as it turned out, that this would lead inevitably to a direct Allied assault on Italy. Hitler, preoccupied as he was with the failure of the Russians to cease their infernal resistance, did not take this first intelligence very seriously. At a meeting of OKW on October 15th, Jodl suggested that Vichy France be permitted to send reinforcements to North Africa so that the French could repel any Anglo-American landings. The Führer, according to the OKW diary, turned the suggestion down because it might ruffle the Italians, who were jealous of any move to strengthen France. At the Supreme Commander's headquarters, the matter appears to have been forgotten until November 3rd. But on that day, although German agents on the Spanish side of Gibraltar had reported seeing a great Anglo-American fleet gathering there, Hitler was too busy rallying Rommel at El Alamein to bother with what appeared to him to be merely another convoy for Malta. On November 5th, OKW was informed that one British naval force had sailed out of Gibraltar headed east. But it was not until the morning of November 7th, 12 hours before American and British troops began landing in North Africa, that Hitler gave the latest intelligence from Gibraltar some thought. The forenoon reports received at his headquarters in East Prussia were that British naval forces in Gibraltar and a vast fleet of transports and warships from the Atlantic had joined up and were steaming east into the Mediterranean. There was a long discussion among the staff officers and the Führer. What did it all mean? What was the objective of such a large naval force? Hitler was now inclined to believe, he said, that the Western Allies might be attempting a major landing with some 4 or 5 divisions at Tripoli or Benghazi in order to catch Rommel in the rear. Admiral Kranke, The naval liaison officer at OKW declared that there could not be more than 2 enemy divisions at the most. Even so, something had to be done. Hitler asked that the Luftwaffe in the Mediterranean be immediately reinforced, but was told that this was impossible for the moment. Judging by the OKW diary, all that Hitler did that morning was to notify Rundstedt, commander-in-chief in the West, to be ready to carry out Anton. This was the code word for the occupation of the rest of France. Whereupon the Supreme Commander, heedless of this ominous news or of the plight of Rommel, who would be trapped if the Anglo-Americans landed behind him, or of the latest intelligence warning of an imminent Russian counteroffensive on the Don in the rear of the 6th Army at Stalingrad, entrained after lunch on November 7th for Munich, where on the next evening he was scheduled to deliver his annual speech to his old party cronies gathered to celebrate the anniversary of the Beer Hall Putsch. I learned from Hitler's captured daily calendar book that the celebration had been moved from the old Bürgerbräukeller, where the putsch had taken place, to a more elegant beer hall in Munich, the Löwenbräukeller. The Bürgerbräukeller, it will be remembered, had been wrecked by a time bomb, which had just missed killing the Führer on the night of November 8, 1939. The politician in him, as Halder noted, had got the upper hand of the soldier at a critical moment in the war. Supreme headquarters in East Prussia was left in charge of a colonel, one Freiherr Troitsch von Butler-Brandenfels. Generals Keitel and Jodl, the chief officers of OKW, went along to participate in the beerhouse festivities. There is something weird and batty about such goings-on that take the supreme warlord, who by now was insisting on directing the war on far-flung fronts down to the divisional or regimental or even battalion level, thousands of miles from the battlefields on an unimportant political errand at a moment when the house is beginning to fall in. A change in the man, a corrosion, a deterioration has set in, as it already had with Goering, who, though his once all-powerful Luftwaffe had been steadily declining, was becoming more and more attached to his jewels and his toy trains, with little time to spare for the ugly realities of a prolonged and increasingly bitter war. Anglo-American troops under General Eisenhower hit the beaches of Morocco and Algeria at 1:30 a.m. on November 8, 1942. And at 5:30, Ribbentrop was on the phone from Munich to Ciano in Rome to give him the news. He was rather nervous, Ciano wrote in his diary, and wanted to know what we intended to do. I must confess that having been caught unawares, I was too sleepy to give a very satisfactory answer. The Italian foreign minister learned from the German embassy that the officials there were literally terrified by the blow. Hitler's special train from East Prussia did not arrive in Munich until 3:40 that afternoon, and the first reports he got about the Allied landings in northwest Africa were optimistic. Everywhere the French, he was told, were putting up stubborn resistance, and at Algiers and Oran they had repulsed the landing attempts. In Algeria, Germany's friend, Admiral Darlan, was organizing the defense with the approval of the Vichy regime. Hitler's first reactions were confused. He ordered the garrison at Crete, which was quite outside the new theater of war, immediately strengthened, explaining that such a step was as important as sending reinforcements to Africa. He instructed the Gestapo to bring Generals Weygand and Giraud to Vichy and to keep them under surveillance. General Giraud at that moment was arriving in Algiers. He had escaped from a German POW camp and settled in the south of France, where he was taken off by a British submarine on November 5th and brought to Gibraltar to confer with Eisenhower just before the landings. He asked Field Marshal von Rundstedt to set in action Anton, but not to cross the line of demarcation in France until he had further orders. And he requested Ciano and Pierre Laval, who was now Premier of Vichy France, to meet him in Munich the next day. During the night, Ciano wrote in his diary on November 9th, Ribbentrop telephoned, "Either the Duce or I must go to Munich as soon as possible. Laval will also be there. I wake up the Duce. He is not very anxious to leave, especially since he is not feeling very well. I shall go." For about 24 hours, Hitler toyed with the idea of trying to make an alliance with France in order to bring her into the war against Britain and America, and at the moment to strengthen the resolve of the Pétain government to oppose the Allied landings in North Africa. He probably was encouraged in this by the action of Pétain in breaking off diplomatic relations with the United States on the morning of Sunday, November 8th, and by the aged French marshal's statement to the U.S. chargé d'affaires that his forces would resist the Anglo-American invasion. The OKW diary for that Sunday emphasizes that Hitler was preoccupied with working out a far-reaching collaboration with the French. That evening, the German representative in Vichy, Krug von Nieder, submitted a proposal to Pétain for a close alliance between Germany and France. By the next day, following his speech to the party veterans in which he proclaimed that Stalingrad was firmly in German hands, the Führer had changed his mind. He told Ciano he had no illusions about the French desire to fight and that he had decided on the total occupation of France, a landing in Corsica, a bridgehead in Tunisia. This decision, though not the timing, was communicated to Laval when he arrived in Munich by car on November 10th. This traitorous Frenchman promptly promised to urge Pétain to accede to the Führer's wishes, but suggested that the Germans go ahead with their plans without waiting for the senile old marshal's approval, which Hitler fully intended to do. Ciano has left a description of the Vichy premier, who was executed for treason after the war. Laval, with his white tie and middle-class French peasant attire, is very much out of place in the great salon among so many uniforms. He tries to speak in a familiar tone about his trip and his long sleep in the car, but his words go unheeded. Hitler treats him with frigid courtesy. The poor man could not even imagine the fait accompli that the Germans were to place before him. Not a word was said to Laval about the impending action, that the orders to occupy France were being given while he was smoking his cigarette and conversing with various people in the next room. Von Ribbentrop told me that Laval would be informed only the next morning at 8 o'clock that on account of information received during the night, Hitler had been obliged to proceed to the total occupation of the country. The orders for the seizure of unoccupied France, in clear violation of the armistice agreement, were given by Hitler at 8:30 p.m. on November 10th and carried out the next morning without any other incident than a futile protest by Pétain. The Italians occupied Corsica, and German planes began flying in troops to seize French-held Tunisia before Eisenhower's forces could get there. There was one further and typical piece of Hitlerian deceit. On November 13th, the Führer assured Pétain that neither the Germans nor the Italians would occupy the naval base at Toulon, where the French fleet had been tied up since the armistice. On November 25th, the OKW diary recorded that Hitler had decided to carry out Lille as soon as possible. It is only fair to point out that Hitler strongly suspected, not without reason, that the French fleet might try to sail for Algeria and join the Allies. Despite his treacherous dealings with the Germans and his violent hatred of the British, Admiral Darlan, who happened to be visiting an ailing son at Algiers, had been pressed into service by Eisenhower as French commander in North Africa, not only because he seemed to be the only officer who could get the French army and navy to cease resisting the Anglo-American landings, but also in the hope that he could get the admiral commanding in Tunisia to oppose the German landings there, and also induce the French fleet in Toulon to make a dash for North Africa. The hopes proved vain, although Darlan tried. To his message ordering Admiral de Laborde to bring the fleet over from Toulon, he received an answer in one expressive, if indelicate, word: merde. See the Procès du Monsieur Pétain. Lille was the code word for the occupation of Toulon and the capture of the French fleet. On the morning of the 27th, German troops attacked the naval port, but French sailors held them up long enough to allow the crews, on the orders of Admiral de Laborde, to scuttle the ships. The French fleet was thus lost to the Axis, which badly needed its warships in the Mediterranean, but it was denied also to the Allies, to whom it would have been a most valuable addition. Hitler won the race against Eisenhower to seize Tunisia, but it was a doubtful victory. At his insistence, nearly a quarter of a million German and Italian troops were poured in to hold this bridgehead. If the Führer had sent one-fifth as many troops and tanks to Rommel a few months before, the Desert Fox most probably would have been beyond the Nile by now, the Anglo-American landing in northwest Africa could not have taken place, and the Mediterranean would have been irretrievably lost to the Allies, thus securing the soft undercover of the Axis belly. As it was, every soldier and tank and gun rushed by Hitler to Tunisia that winter, as well as the remnants of the Afrika Corps, would be lost by the end of the spring. Some 125,000 Germans, according to General Eisenhower, out of a total of 240,000 Axis troops, the rest being Italian. This number includes only those who surrendered during the last week of the campaign, May 5th to 12th, 1943, Crusade in Europe, page 156. And more German troops would be marched into prisoner of war cages than at Stalingrad, to which we must now return. Disaster at Stalingrad. Hitler and the principal generals of OKW were lingering on in the pleasant alpine surroundings of Berchtesgaden when the first news of the Russian counteroffensive on the Don reached them a few hours after it had been launched in a blizzard at dawn on November 19th. Though a Soviet attack in this region had been expected, it was not believed at OKW that it would amount to enough to warrant Hitler and his chief military advisers, Keitel and Jodl, hurrying back to headquarters in East Prussia after the Führer's ringing beer-house speech to the old party comrades in Munich on the evening of November 8th. So, they had puttered about on the Obersalzberg, taking in the mountain air. Their peace and quiet was abruptly broken by an urgent telephone call from General Zeitzler, the new chief of the Army General Staff, who had remained behind at Rostenburg. He had what the OKW diary recorded as alarming news. In the very first hours of the attack, an overwhelming Russian armored force had broken clean through the Romanian Third Army between Serafimovich and Kletskaya on the Don, just northwest of Stalingrad. South of the besieged city, other powerful Soviet forces were attacking strongly against the German Fourth Panzer Army and the Romanian Fourth Army, and threatening to pierce their fronts. The Russian objective was obvious to anyone who looked at a map, and especially obvious to Zeitzler, who, from army intelligence, knew that the enemy had massed 13 armies with thousands of tanks in the south to achieve it. The Russians were clearly driving in great strength from the north and the south to cut off Stalingrad and to force the German 6th Army there to either beat a hasty retreat to the west or see itself surrounded. Zeitzler later contended that as soon as he saw what was happening, he urged Hitler to permit the 6th Army to withdraw from Stalingrad to the Don Bend, where the broken front could be restored. The mere suggestion threw the Führer into a tantrum. "I won't leave the Volga! I won't go back from the Volga!" he shouted. And that was that. This decision, taken in such a fit of frenzy, led promptly to disaster. The Führer personally ordered the 6th Army to stand fast around Stalingrad. Hitler and his staff returned to headquarters on November 22nd. By this time, the fourth day of the attack, the news was catastrophic. The two Soviet forces from the north and south had met at Kalach, 40 miles west of Stalingrad on the Don Bend. In the evening, a wireless message arrived from General Paulus, commander of the 6th Army, confirming that his troops were now surrounded. Hitler promptly radioed back, telling Paulus to move his headquarters into the city and form a hedgehog defense. The 6th Army would be supplied by air until it could be relieved. But this was futile talk. There were now 20 German and 2 Romanian divisions cut off at Stalingrad. Paulus radioed that they would need a minimum of 750 tons of supplies a day flown in. This was far beyond the capacity of the Luftwaffe, which lacked the required number of transport planes. Even if they had been available, not all of them could have got through in the blizzardy weather and over an area where the Russians had now established fighter superiority. Nevertheless, Goering assured Hitler that the Air Force could do the job. It never began to. The relief of the 6th Army was a more practical and encouraging possibility. On November 25th, Hitler had recalled Field Marshal von Manstein, the most gifted of his field commanders, from the Leningrad front and put him in charge of a newly created formation, Army Group Don. His assignment was to push through from the southwest and relieve the 6th Army at Stalingrad. But now the Führer imposed impossible conditions on his new commander. Manstein tried to explain to him that the only chance of success lay in the 6th Army's breaking out of Stalingrad to the west, while his own forces, led by the 4th Panzer Army, pressed northeast against the Russian armies which lay between the two German forces. But once again Hitler refused to draw back from the Volga. The 6th Army must remain in Stalingrad, and Manstein must fight his way to it there. This, as Manstein tried to argue with the Supreme Warlord, could not be done. The Russians were too strong. Nevertheless, with a heavy heart, Manstein launched his attack on December 12th. It was called, appropriately, Operation Winter Gale, for the full fury of the Russian winter had now hit the southern steppes, piling up the snow in drifts and dropping the temperature below zero. At first, the offensive made good progress. The 4th Panzer Army, under General Hoth, driving northeast up both sides of the railroad from Kotelnikovsky toward Stalingrad, some 75 miles away. By December 19th, it had advanced to within some 40 miles of the southern perimeter of the city. By the 21st, it was within 30 miles, and across the snowy steppes the besieged troops of the 6th Army could see at night the signal flares of their rescuers. At this moment, according to the later testimony of the German generals, a breakout from Stalingrad of the 6th Army toward the advancing lines of the 4th Panzer Army would almost certainly have succeeded. But once again, Hitler forbade it. On December 21st, Zeitzler had wrung permission from the leader for the troops of Paulus to break out, provided they also held on to Stalingrad. This piece of foolishness, the general staff chief says, nearly drove him insane. On the following evening, Zeitzler related later, I begged Hitler to authorize the breakout. I pointed out that this was absolutely our last chance to save the 200,000 men of Paulus's army. Hitler would not give way. In vain, I described to him conditions inside the so-called fortress, the despair of the starving soldiers, their loss of confidence in the supreme command, the wounded expiring for lack of proper attention while thousands froze to death. He remained as impervious to arguments of this sort as to those others which I had advanced. In the face of increasing Russian resistance in front of him and on his flanks, General Hoth lacked the strength to negotiate that last 30 miles to Stalingrad. He believed that if the 6th Army broke out, he could still make a junction with it, and then both forces could withdraw to Kotelnikovsky. This at least would save a couple of 100,000 German lives. In his post-war memoirs, Field Marshal von Manstein says that on December 19th, in disobedience to Hitler's orders, he actually directed the 6th Army to begin to break out of Stalingrad to the southwest and make a junction with the 4th Panzer Army. He publishes the text of the directive, but it contained certain reservations, and Paulus, who was still under orders from Hitler not to break out, must have been greatly confused by it. This, declares Manstein, was our one and only chance of saving the 6th Army. Manstein, Lost Victories, pages 336 to 341 and 562 to 563. Probably for a day or two, between December 21st and 23rd, this could have been done, but by the latter date it had become impossible. For unknown to Hoth, the Red Army had struck farther north and was now endangering the left flank of Manstein's whole army group Don. On the night of December 22nd, Manstein telephoned Hoth to prepare himself for drastic new orders. The next day they came. Hoth was to abandon his drive on Stalingrad, dispatch one of his three panzer divisions to the Don front on the north, and defend himself where he was and with what he had left as well as he could. The attempt to relieve Stalingrad had failed. Manstein's drastic new orders had come as the result of alarming news that reached him on December 17th. On the morning of that day, a Soviet army had broken through the Italian 8th Army farther up the Don at Bogachar, and by evening opened a gap 27 miles deep. Within 3 days, the hole was 90 miles wide. The Italians were fleeing in panic, and the Romanian 3rd Army to the south, which already had been badly pummeled on the opening day of the Russian offensive on November 19th, was also disintegrating. No wonder Manstein had had to take part of Hoth's armored forces to help stem the gap. A chain reaction followed. Not only the Don armies fell back, but also Hoth's forces, which had come so close to Stalingrad. These retreats in turn endangered the German army in the Caucasus, which would be cut off if the Russians reached Rostov on the Sea of Azov. A day or two after Christmas, Zeitzler pointed out to Hitler, "Unless you order a withdrawal from the Caucasus now, we shall soon have a second Stalingrad on our hands." Reluctantly, the Supreme Commander issued the necessary instructions on December 29th to Kleist's Army Group A, which comprised the 1st Panzer and 17th Armies, and which had failed in its mission to grab the rich oil fields of Grozny. It too began a long retreat after having been within sight of its goal. The reverses of the Germans in Russia and of the Italo-German armies in North Africa stirred Mussolini to thought. Hitler had invited him to come to Salzburg for a talk around the middle of December, and the ailing Duce, now on a strict diet for stomach disorders, had accepted, though as he told Chano he would go on one condition only, that he take his meals alone, because he does not want a lot of ravenous Germans to notice that he is compelled to live on rice and milk. The time had come, Mussolini decided, to tell Hitler to cut his losses in the East, make some sort of deal with Stalin, and concentrate Axis strength on defending the rest of North Africa, the Balkans, and Western Europe. 1943 will be the year of the Anglo-American effort, he told Chano. Hitler was unable to leave his eastern headquarters in order to meet Mussolini, so Chano made the long journey to Rastenburg on December 18th on his behalf, repeating to the Nazi leader the Duce's proposals. Hitler scorned them and assured the Italian foreign minister that without at all weakening the Russian front, he could send additional forces to North Africa, which must, he said, be held. Chano found German spirits at a low ebb at headquarters, despite Hitler's confident assurances. The atmosphere is heavy. To the bad news there should perhaps be added the sadness of that humid forest and the boredom of collective living in the barracks. No one tries to conceal from me the unhappiness over the news of the breakthrough on the Russian front. There were open attempts to put the blame on us. At that very moment, the survivors of the Italian Eighth Army on the Don were scurrying for their lives, and when one member of Chano's party asked an OKW officer whether the Italians had suffered heavy losses, he was told, "No losses at all, they are running." The German troops in the Caucasus and on the Don, if not running, were getting out as quickly as they could to avoid being cut off. Each day, as the year 1943 began, they withdrew a little farther from Stalingrad. The time had now come for the Russians to finish off the Germans there. But first, they gave the doomed soldiers of the Sixth Army an opportunity to save their lives. On the morning of January 8, 1943, three young Red Army officers bearing a white flag entered the German lines on the northern perimeter of Stalingrad and presented General Paulus with an ultimatum from General Rokossovsky, commander of the Soviet forces on the Don front. After reminding him that his army was cut off and could not be relieved or kept supplied from the air, the note said, "The situation of your troops is desperate. They are suffering from hunger, sickness, and cold. The cruel Russian winter has scarcely yet begun. Hard frosts, cold winds, and blizzards still lie ahead. Your soldiers are unprovided with winter clothing and are living in appalling sanitary conditions. Your situation is hopeless and any further resistance senseless. In view of this, and in order to avoid unnecessary bloodshed, we propose that you accept the following terms of surrender." They were honorable terms. All prisoners would be given normal rations. The wounded, sick, and frostbitten would receive medical treatment. All prisoners could retain their badges of rank, decorations, and personal belongings. Paulus was given 24 hours to reply. He immediately radioed the text of the ultimatum to Hitler and asked for freedom of action. His request was curtly dismissed by the Supreme Warlord. 24 hours after the expiration of the time limit on the demand for surrender, on the morning of January 10th, the Russians opened the last phase of the Battle of Stalingrad with an artillery bombardment from 5,000 guns. The fighting was bitter and bloody. Both sides fought with incredible bravery and recklessness over the frozen wasteland of the city's rubble. But not for long. Within 6 days, the German pocket had been reduced by half to an area 15 miles long and 9 miles deep at its widest. By January 24th, it had been split in two and the last small emergency airstrip lost. The planes which had brought in some supplies, especially medicines for the sick and wounded, and which had flown out 29,000 hospital cases, could no longer land. Once more, the Russians gave their courageous enemy a chance to surrender. Soviet emissaries arrived at the German lines on January 24th with a new offer. Again, Paulus, torn between his duty to obey the mad Führer and his obligation to save his own surviving troops from annihilation, appealed to Hitler. "Troops without ammunition," he radioed on the 24th, "or food. Effective command no longer possible. 18,000 wounded without any supplies or dressings or drugs. Further defense senseless. Collapse inevitable. Army requests immediate permission to surrender in order to save lives of remaining troops." Hitler's answer has been preserved. "Surrender is forbidden. Sixth Army will hold their positions to the last man and the last round, and by their heroic endurance will make an unforgettable contribution toward the establishment of a defensive front and the salvation of the Western world." The Western world. It was a bitter pill for the men of the Sixth Army who had fought against that world in France and Flanders but a short time ago. Further resistance was not only senseless and futile, but impossible. And as the month of January 1943 approached its end, the epic battle wore itself out, expiring like the flame of an expended candle which sputters and dies. By January 28th, what was left of a once great army was split into three small pockets, in the southern one of which General Paulus had his headquarters in the cellar of the ruins of the once thriving Univermag department store. According to one eyewitness, the commander-in-chief sat on his camp bed in a darkened corner, in a state of near collapse. He was scarcely in the mood, nor were his soldiers, to appreciate the flood of congratulatory radiograms that now began to pour in. Goering, who had whiled away a good part of the winter in sunny Italy, strutting about in his great fur coat and fingering his jewels, sent a radio message on January 28th. "The fight put up by the Sixth Army will go down in history, and future generations will speak proudly of a Langemarck of daredeviltry, an Alcazar of tenacity, a Narvik of courage, and a Stalingrad of self-sacrifice." Nor were they cheered when on the last evening, January 30th, 1943, the 10th anniversary of the Nazis coming to power, they listened to the fat Reich Marshal's bombastic broadcast. "A thousand years hence, Germans will speak of this battle, of Stalingrad, with reverence and awe, and will remember that in spite of everything, Germany's ultimate victory was decided there. In years to come, it will be said of the heroic battle on the Volga, 'When you come to Germany, say that you have seen us lying at Stalingrad, as our honor and our leaders ordained that we should, for the greater glory of Germany.'" The glory and the horrible agony of the Sixth Army had now come to an end. On January 30th, Paulus radioed Hitler, "Final collapse cannot be delayed more than 24 hours. This signal prompted the Supreme Commander to shower a series of promotions on the doomed officers in Stalingrad, apparently in the hope that such honors would strengthen their resolve to die gloriously at their bloody posts. "There is no record in military history of a German field marshal being taken prisoner," Hitler remarked to Jodl, and thereupon conferred on Paulus by radio the coveted marshal's baton. Some 117 other officers were jumped up a grade. It was a macabre gesture. The end itself was anticlimactic. Late on the last day of January, Paulus got off his final message to headquarters. "The Sixth Army, true to their oath and conscious of the lofty importance of their mission, have held their position to the last man and the last round, for Führer and Fatherland, unto the end." At 7:45 p.m., the radio operator at Sixth Army headquarters sent a last message on his own. "The Russians are at the door of our bunker. We are destroying our equipment." He added the letters CL, the international wireless code signifying, "This station will no longer transmit." There was no last-minute fighting at headquarters. Paulus and his staff did not hold out to the last man. A squad of Russians led by a junior officer peered into the commander-in-chief's darkened hole in the cellar. The Russians demanded surrender, and the Sixth Army's chief of staff, General Schmidt, accepted. Paulus sat dejected on his camp bed. When Schmidt addressed him, "May I ask the field marshal if there is anything more to be said?" Paulus was too weary to answer. Farther north, a small German pocket, containing all that was left of two panzer and four infantry divisions, still held out in the ruins of a tractor factory. On the night of February 1st, it received a message from Hitler's headquarters. "The German people expect you to do your duty exactly as did the troops holding the southern fortress. Every day and every hour that you continue to fight facilitates the building of a new front." Just before noon on February 2nd, this group surrendered after a last message to the Supreme Commander. "Have fought to the last man against vastly superior forces. Long live Germany." Silence at last settled on the snow-covered, blood-spattered shambles of the battlefield. At 2:46 p.m. on February 2nd, a German reconnaissance plane flew high over the city and radioed back, "No sign of any fighting at Stalingrad." By that time, 91,000 German soldiers, including 24 generals, half-starved, frost-bitten, many of them wounded, all of them dazed and broken, were hobbling over the ice and snow, clutching their blood-caked blankets over their heads against the 24 degrees below zero cold, toward the dreary, frozen prisoner of war camps of Siberia. Except for some 20,000 Romanians and the 29,000 wounded who had been evacuated by air, they were all that was left of a conquering army that had numbered 285,000 men 2 months before. The rest had been slaughtered. And of those 91,000 Germans who began the weary march into captivity that winter day, only 5,000 were destined ever to see the fatherland again.